we had this afternoon a guest speaker, and I feel rather absurd introducing him to most of you because you are probably more knowledgeable of his activities and of him himself than I am. But I have a few items here which, in introducing him, I would like to bring to your attention because I consider them of worthy note. Interesting to note that Senator Green originally intended to become a physician so that he might follow in the footsteps of his father, who had achieved eminence in New York. He graduated from Harvard College with the class of 1907 and from the Harvard Medical School the class of 1912. And from there, he moved on to a career as newspaper, magazine editor, author, government official, governor of Alaska, and general practitioner in the public service. The dedication of his energies over the two decades to the cause of Alaskan statehood was climaxed by the admission of the 49th state and his election to the United States Senate, where he took office January 7, 1959. Now, he has a most remarkably varied background, and I want to just make a few notations here of his performance and record in journalism. One of his most notable achievements was the following World War I tour of duty in the field artillery of the United States. Senator Green became managing editor of The Nation magazine, where he remained until 1923. Later, he served as the national director of publicity for the Robert La Follette presidential campaign of 1924. And after this campaign, he wrote the definitive volume Mexico and Its Heritage, published in 1928 and still in print 31 years later. In 1933, when Franklin Roosevelt became president, Senator Green was appointed as advisor to the United States delegation headed by the Secretary of State Cordell Hull to the 7th Inter-American Conference at Montevideo. He was appointed by President Roosevelt, the first director of the Division of Territories and Island Possessions, which was a new agency created by President Roosevelt under the Department of Interior. In 1938, he was appointed a member of the Alaska International Highway Commission. In 1939, August of 1939, he was appointed governor for the territory of Alaska. And I would like to quote the comments that was made by U.S. News upon the appointment of Senator Green. I quote, "This week, a 52-year-old government official will set out for a vast, almost uninhabited wilderness, a land one-fifth the size of the United States, a land of forests and fish and minerals, a land with only 60,000 human beings, one person for every 10 square miles, the wilderness, Alaska," the official, Dr. Ernest Green, the territory's newly appointed governor. "That Dr. Green may have something up his sleeve is evident from a statement he made last week in which he said that democracy has no business having colonies and urged that American territories be prepared for a political equality with states." When he came to Alaska, the new governor found that there was discrimination in public places against Alaskan Native, Indians, Aleuts, and Eskimos. This he vigorously opposed, both privately and publicly. Polling places in Eskimo and other communities were established. Owing to the former lack of polling places, the inhabitants had been disenfranchised. He fought and diminished the stupidities of war censorship of the Alaskan males. He struggled valiantly for the territorial equality of Alaska among the other states. And with Delegate Bartlett, he fought against the abolition of the cost of living differential for federal employees. And when a governor, he established the first full-time Department of Health. Now, he was instrumental in the Constitutional Convention. He participated with the Bartlett and Egan, who were sent to Washington to lobby, in effect, for statehood. And when statehood was finally granted, Mr. Green put himself before the electorate for election and was elected as a senator from the state of Alaska. Now, I would like to introduce you to Senator Green, and I think we will change the format of this afternoon's class a bit. He spoke this morning, and answered two or three questions, which had promise of being a very lively discussion, and I think those people promised they would come back. I don't know whether they did. But Senator Green this afternoon thought that he would like to start off immediately by answering questions and perhaps just have an informal question and answer period for as much time as class will permit. So at this time, I would like to present to you Senator Green. Well, this morning we ran out of time, and there were a couple of questions, and evidently more questions wanted to be asked. And I thought if this was agreeable, we would start with a question period, and if we run out of questions, we'll ask and just talk. But there's such an awful lot to talk about in our recent history, the state development that took place, just before you really were probably conscious of it, the battle for statehood. It really dates from the very beginning of the Treaty of Session, but only became active in the middle 1940s and culminated in 1958 when we finally got statehood. And then the problems that we've inherited from the 92 years of stepchildhood when we neglected and discriminated against, and have some of those problems sort of solved. And I think it's extremely important and desirable that all those who are citizens, future citizens of this great state, as many of you already are and will be as soon as you reach the age of 19, because of the wisdom of our Constitution Convention in making the voting age 19. And so it is important that you realize why we've inherited some of these problems, why we have largely a condition of roadlessness in our state, why we have so little power development, why we have such high steamship freight rates, why there is so much poverty among our native people, and why the land problems are suddenly thrust upon us. So I thought maybe it would be well if we had a few questions for a while, and then if you run out of questions, I'd be glad to talk on any aspect of this important field that you could have. Yeah. So let's go ahead if you have any questions, and I'll be glad to answer them. You don't have to limit yourself to any particular subject. When I was in medical school many years ago, the newspapers used to carry what is known as medical advertising, which has since not been carried. This is the advertisement of quack doctors, because of course the reputable physicians don't ever advertise. That's against the ethics of the profession. And there was one doctor in Boston newspaper where I was managing editor, who used to advertise old Dr. Jones, specialist, all diseases. It struck me at the time that that was a pretty good definition of a newspaper man. In those days, you were specialist, all diseases. And when you get to the Senate and elected to office, you have to be a specialist in almost all the problems of your constituents, and they're very numerous. You don't always succeed, but you try. Yes, going back there. The question is, I think, how much are the fiscal policy of the United States off base? Is that about it? Well, I think they're way off, because we're so overcommitted to be the world's policeman. And we have now reached a staggering budget of $79 billion annually, which is more than half our total budget. And that is largely spent in stationing our troops all over the world and getting ourselves into wars where we have no business to be. And so I say that our budget was completely out of balance. There is no justification whatever for our being in Vietnam, in my judgment, just militarily. There's no justification for having 340,000 troops in Europe. The reason they were sent there when NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Alliance, was consummated in the late 40s, those conditions have ceased to exist. The European nations are extremely prosperous and could defend themselves if necessary.
But if we insist on carrying on policies that are obsolete. We have 40,000 troops in Japan. When I was there a few months ago, I discovered this to my surprise. And when I asked one of the ranking officers why we have to have 40,000 troops in Japan, he said, didn't you know? Japanese went pacifist after the war, and we've got to stay here and defend them. Well, I said, have they asked us to? And he said, well, they haven't objected. I don't know why they could have. What objective? We pay all the bills. One of the most prosperous countries on earth, and if they want defense, they should pay for themselves. We now have 500,000 men in Southeast Asia. We have 56,000 in Korea. We have 30,000 in Okinawa. And I can see no justification for it, whatever. And meanwhile, all our important domestic programs that are needed and overdue, health, education, welfare, resource development, pollution control, all the various accumulated problems, rampant crime, are being neglected while we're spending our substance overseas in places where we ask ourselves in and where it's very doubtful whether they're wanted or whether being there is desirable. So I would say that our budget is completely out of balance and our fiscal policy very regrettable and unnecessary. Yes. Can you hear that question? It would be a good idea if you'd repeat the question for a moment. That doesn't affect the policy of Alaska at all, except that we, like the rest of the states, the other 49 states, are paying the price in having our important project slighted. And in a way, it's more serious for Alaska than it is for the states, because we were so much neglected during the 92 years that we were territory. We have a lot of catching up to do, and consequently, when public works are cut, as they are all over the United States, and Corps of Engineers projects are eliminated or reduced or suspended, relatively we are worse off. Now, for instance, the whole road program of the United States has been suspended. Well, the road program has been going on very merrily in the United States for 50 years. Ours has barely begun. Consequently, relatively, we suffer more than the other states because we have much further to go. So that I would say that the war does affect us very seriously as it affects other states, but relatively more. Oh, my personal stand has had nothing whatever to do with it. Nothing whatever. Well, I am an enthusiastic supporter of the Rampart Dam. We need low-cost electricity in Alaska. It's very high now. Electric current has become a commodity almost important to modern life. It's the water that we drink. It's very costly. Our whole cost of living is high, and if we could reduce the cost of living, to reducing the cost of that essential commodity would be helpful all around. And in addition to that, we need a more diversified economy. Our economy is largely based on the fisheries and mining. The fisheries were very sadly depleted during the period of federal territorialism, owing to the mismanagement of the federal agency which was in control of it. Under its mismanagement, this great fishery resource dropped to its lowest point in 60 years after the end of federal government. Territorial government, from highs of over 7 million cases in the 30s, it dropped to 1,600,000 cases, which was disastrous not only for itself, but for the economy of our coastal communities dependent on it. Our mining, which is principally gold, has virtually disappeared because of a federal policy which prevents us from doing anything to help the gold miners on the mistaken assumption that any time we try to help the gold mining industry, it'll cause a run on the dollar and an international panic, a theory that none of us in the Congress share, but which we are unable to overcome because of the threat of a veto of any legislation that will help the gold miners. Now, the one thing that is coming to save us or help us is the coming of oil, which is rapidly fought by the conservationist groups to prophesy death and destruction to the moose if we drilled in the Kenai Peninsula, a prophecy which we knew was ridiculous and so true. And these same groups are now fighting the Rampart Dam for analogous reasons. Now, in addition to that, as I say, we have no statewide economy. The fisheries have are coming back, but they're not sufficient. Oil is important, it's in one section of Alaska. And we need a statewide economy with industry with supply. Observing what has happened in Norway, for instance, where they've harnessed their hydroelectric power very effectively, they've brought in a lot of very desirable industries which we could. They're making a fertilizer by extracting nitrogen from the air, in addition to which we could make phosphate fertilizer because of the phosphate rocks in the south slope of the Brooks Range. And the extraction of magnesia from salt water and converting it to metallic magnesium. And the bringing of bauxite in and converting it to alumina, which is the last step before you make metallic aluminum. All those things are made possible by large quantities of cheap power. And that is one of the things, or among the things, that Rampart would do. And for those reasons, I favor it. What's wrong with what? Well, atomic power is still in the experimental stage, and we have the great problem of disposing of atomic waste. And until we find a way of disposing of it so it doesn't pollute the ground and the air, there'll be considerable danger. Now, actually, I think that as our populations grow and our demands increase, we're going to need every form of power. We're going to need hydroelectric power, and we may need atomic power, and we may have to use gas. But I think we should diversify and use as many of these as we can. They will all be needed as our population and our demands grow. Yes, and back.
What about the supposed
building
up
of the Utah Black Lake
behind
it? Yeah. The fill up is what? Well, the Corps of Engineers deny that and say that's not true. That will be disposed of. I'm prepared to take the judgment of the engineering experts. It's correct. Big one? What about an earthquake? Well, this was north of the earthquake belt. Rampart is situated quite a bit north of Fairbanks, and the earthquake didn't go that far. It might the next time, but that's a risk we have to take under any circumstances. Yes. Well, the Wood Canyon Dam, I think, would destroy a very valuable, or might impair a very valuable fishery resource. The Copper River fisheries are extremely important, and I think you'd get much more objection from the fishermen to the Wood Canyon Dam and besides this. It will not produce the quantity of power at the low rate that the Rampart Dam would produce. The cost of power in the Wood Canyon Dam would be substantially higher, and the difference of even one or two or three mils per kilowatt will make the difference between it being useful for industry or not being useful. Yes.
What is the current situation of the Rampart Dam?
The current situation is that some of our extremists among my fellow conservationists have been carrying on a very active campaign against it, and they have more or less captured the Secretary of Interior, who is not for it, but of course the decision will be ultimately made by the Corps of Engineers. And I do not share the apprehensions of some of these extremists among my fellow conservationists that the moose will be destroyed. And we heard the same story when we were going to drill in a moose range, and it didn't destroy the moose. In fact, the moose multiplied so fast that we now have a superabundance of them. Before the drilling in the Kenai Moose Range started, we never had the moose in the Mount Moose Valley. Now they've become a pest, and they eat the farmers' crops and push down the fences. And this is a subject of complaint which we hear from farmers constantly writing, asking me to do something about these predatory moose. And I explored the situation, thinking we might be able to get crop insurance, and I found there was crop insurance available for insect damage, flood damage, frost damage, wind damage, but not for moose damage. And however, we have made a proposal. They can insure against moose damage, but the rates are pretty high. As far as the destruction of the moose alleged by these extremists in the place where the lake would be, I suspect that in the 18 years between the time the lake starts filling up and it fills, the moose will not just stand there and slowly drown. I think they'll have sense enough to move or swim off into the remaining 576,000 square miles of Alaska. Yes. You say there might be grass in our government? I said there's grass in our government? Oh, no, I didn't say that. No, I never said any such thing. Oh, I said there was grass in Vietnam among the junta, those 10 generals whom we support, and the general population. Corruption is a kind of a way of life down in Asia, and it's present in a very large degree there. But I want to make plain that I didn't attribute that to our government. We wouldn't do any such things here. But we are supporting these people, and a lot of taxpayers' dollars, whenever you refer to dollars, you always say taxpayers' dollars, are going down the drain quite needlessly. And of course, there has been some corruption in other aspects of our foreign aid program, not by our officials, but by the people to whom the money goes in some foreign country. Yes. Well, the Congress has a subsidy for ships built in our shipyards to equalize the difference between the cost of building a home because of our high wage scales and abroad. But I do not think that program has gone quite far enough. I think we should go a little further if we want to maintain shipbuilding at home. There's always a great temptation on the part of people who want to acquire ships to acquire them in foreign shipyards because they are very much cheaper. But that is not helpful to our standard of living, and I think we should go so much further in this field. This, in the Senate, is a problem of the Commerce Committee, of which Bob Bott is a member. He happens to be chairman of the Subcommittee on Merchant Marine Fisheries, and this very problem is giving him a good deal of concern, and he's looking into it, and he's got some legislation pending, which he hopes, and which we all hope, will improve the situation. Yes, and it's way back. Do I feel people should be able to serve in the Peace Corps instead of in the Army? I don't believe in the draft at all. I think involuntary servitude is absolutely inexcusable in our free society. If our cause is as good as its proponent says it is, why can't we have a volunteer system? Now, actually, in 1965, there were 96,000 desertions in the South Vietnamese Army. Those are our official figures, and I think they're understated. Last year, 1966, there were 110,000. What justification is there for drafting our young men and sending them down there to fight people against whom they have no grievance, who are so little interested in their own cause that they desert in wholesale numbers, and to have our young men killed in the process? Now, if you are part of the regular military establishment, if you've enlisted in the Army or the Navy or the Air Force, naturally you are bound by the orders of the Commander-in-Chief to go where he sends you, and you know that when you enter the military services. But drafting these young men who have no desire to go in this war, who would be perfectly willing to fight if we felt we'd been attacked, or that our security were really jeopardized, or there was a really valid interest in the United States in peril, that would be entirely different. I don't think there's one American out of 100 who wouldn't be willing to fight under those circumstances. But those circumstances are notably absent in our engagement in Southeast Asia. Yes. Well, the government is just beginning to get interested. And this is partly due to the fact that we've been holding hearings for the last 2 years, which has shown the tremendous concern and interest that the people, both at home and abroad, have in this population explosion and the effects it will have and is already having on our natural resources. And the president has spoken vigorously about it some 28 times since his first day of the Union message. But to date, his message hasn't been fully heard or acted upon by his agency. I'm hopeful that that situation will change. Yes. The Concord Treaty, I think it'll pass. I think it requires a two-thirds vote, but I think it will be obtained. I'm not a prophet, but that's just my conjecture. Yes. Did you speak aloud? I couldn't hear it. What is the idea about the war in Japan, Congress? Well, judging from their votes, they're all for it, except two or three of us. In this last appropriation bill, there were three voted against it and the rest voted for it. I think that while most of the members of Congress are extremely unhappy about the situation, a great many of them who were present in 1964 and voted for the Tonkin Gulf Resolution, which gave the president unlimited power at his own discretion to use the armed force of the United States anywhere in Southeast Asia, those who voted for it feel they are somewhat committed. They have, in effect, painted themselves in the corner, and they find it very difficult to get out. Although some of them have expressed unhappiness over the situation, and Senator Fulbright, who was the manager of that resolution on the floor of the Senate, in other words, bringing it to passage, has since admitted publicly and repeatedly that he was mistaken, that he wishes he hadn't done it, that he was wrong. One of the few fine confessions of error, which are not very numerous. Yes. This is the prevailing pressure. Well, my own view, which is colored by the fact that I dissent, is that it is a perfectly valid form of patriotism to criticize your country when you think it's wrong, especially in this case, as there has never been any declaration of war. This has been wholly by executive action, in violation, in my view, of the Constitution, which provides that only the Congress can declare war. Article 1, Section 8, so states. And certainly, as long as we have had no declaration of war, it seems to me that those who defend are perfectly free to do it. If there were a declaration of war, that situation might change, although I'm not sure of that. A very noted American by the name of Abraham Lincoln made a very emphatic attack on the conduct of the war and on the war in Mexico itself after we were in the war. And we don't hold that against Abraham Lincoln. It's true he was defeated for re-election to the House, but ultimately he rose to greater heights. And I think if you feel that your country is making a tragic error, especially when you have a certain responsibility as a member of the Senate, which under the Constitution has a duty to advise and consent in certain aspects of foreign policy, I think one would be derelict if one didn't speak out if one sat in disagreement. That is my feeling. Yes. Well, I think it's a very good idea. There's been a good deal of talk about it. What so frequently happens in Latin America, there is much talk and little action. And I hope that this will proceed. I think it's useful for the economy of these countries. There's no reason why they should have these heavy customs barriers against each other. And I think this is something that we should work for and try to promote as we are. Yes. Well, war and space are sort of sacred cows down there, and any time a request comes from on high that we must enlarge our military capability, which has grown and grown and grown, it usually gets pretty general support. I think we now have such an overkill that it's about time we started cutting down. Our Navy is now more powerful than all the navies the rest of the world combined. Our Air Force is about in the same position. Our military establishment is growing and growing all the time. And while this is happening, our great domestic needs are being eroded. So that really, I think we have a great weakening of our basic strength, which depends on our economy at home and our social levels and our standards of life. And if those continue to deteriorate, we will be in one respect, really losing the wars in which we engage. Well, Mr. Dooley is writing here before most of you are born. Once said the Supreme Court follows the election returns. And I don't know whether the Supreme Court will wait until the next election to see what happens, but it's quite conceivable that this question might be brought up, not in this particular form, but possibly in a case of young men who refuse to serve in this war because they consider it immoral and illegal and unconstitutional, and are then given heavy penalties. Dishonorable discharge and several years in prison. And I think that some of those cases may and should find their way to the Supreme Court. What the Supreme Court will do, of course, I'm not in any position to say. But I certainly think that those basic issues should be tested. Yes. Yes, I certainly do. In the first place, the President has never made a clear offer to negotiate with the people who are doing the fighting, namely the National Liberation Front of Viet Cong. And the reason that hasn't happened is he would destroy the myth that we are fighting aggression from the North. What actually is happening is that we barge into a civil war which is largely of our own making. And we refuse to admit that, and consequently, if we offer to negotiate with the people doing the fighting, that would be an admission. I think the day we offer a clear, make a clear offer to the Viet Cong to negotiate with them, and to cease fire and cease the bombing at the same time, and agree that when the peace is established, we will withdraw, we'd have them at the peace table in a very short time. But that is, none of those things have been tried. The offers he made have all been double-talked. On the one hand, he offered to go back to the Geneva Agreement, which predicated a united Viet Cong after elections throughout the country. And on the other hand, we insist on the independence of South Vietnam. Those two propositions are absolutely incompatible and contradictory. And the adversaries know that very well, and consequently don't take our offer seriously. Yes.
For example, Secretary McNamara has numerous times
Well, this is a very pertinent question. The president has never been given the power to veto items. This is a power which exists in states. It existed in the state of Alaska, in the territory of Alaska. The governor could, as a territorial governor, delete a particular item from the budget. The president does not have that power. It's been sought but never given to him. But nevertheless, it's exercised. It's exercised all the time. Appropriations that are made, authorizations of appropriations, are simply withheld and not put into action. And I think it's completely wrong, and it is one of the symptoms of the abdication of the legislative branch to the executive. This process has been going on for some time, and Congress, I think, is at fault in abdicating many of its powers to the executive. But this is a condition that now exists, and the executive branch can withhold authorizations and appropriations that have been made, and does so. I do not care, I am so sure that I think that's definitely wrong, and it's a violation of the spirit and even of the legality of the procedure. Yes. NATO? Well, I think if we were wise, we would, instead of denouncing the goal, give them a vote of thanks for putting us out of France and calling our attention to his sensible view that the conditions that made NATO desirable 17 years ago no longer exist, and that the people of Europe are able to defend themselves in the unlikely event that the Russians would start marching across Europe, which they're not likely to do now. And in the second place, if they did march across Europe, and the combined forces of all those other 10 nations were insufficient to stop them, we have demonstrated the capability of our airlift, and we could send tens of thousands, or hundreds of thousands of troops over there. But in the meanwhile, while we're complaining about our balance of payments difficulties, we're keeping a million people in Europe, 340,000 troops, and the balance dependent. This is a very heavy drain, and I think it's completely unnecessary. And it is fairly clear that the other nations are not particularly enthusiastic about NATO, but if we now pay all the bills, they don't object. We transfer the headquarters to another nation, and we pay all the transfer costs. And it's a very good source of income. I have a lot of military personnel there buying products of the country and helping the economy of those nations. So they do not object, although it's very evident they're not particularly enthusiastic about our being there. But it is we, the United States, who insist that we must continue this policy, which I think is obviously obsolete. Now, the majority leader of the Senate, Mike Mansfield, who is a very knowledgeable person, has a resolution pending by which he will, which asks us to withdraw a substantial number of our forces. I'm not prepared to say whether it will pass or not, but it represents a very substantial sentiment in the Congress. Yes. Say where? Well, I think the UN is a very desirable institution, even though it hasn't succeeded in all the objectives that we hope for it. I think we should continue to support the UN. I think we should try to make it work. I think if we had utilized it as we were obligated to do under the charter, which we have violated by going into Vietnam, we'd be much better off. Under the charter, which we are signatory, we are obliged to use all kinds of peaceful approaches before using military means, which are definitely forbidden, and we've tried none of them. Under Articles 1 and 2, this is clearly prescribed. Under Article 33, there are 8 different alternative methods of approach to a situation like that in Vietnam where violence broke out. We have used none of them. And a further article prescribes that after we have used these and they don't work, we should refer the matter to the Security Council. And then there's a further provision that if that doesn't work, we should refer to the General Assembly. We have never tried those things, and as long as we do not do that, the United Nations has not been given the chance to show how well it could operate. It has been very useful in stopping border warfare between Israel and Egypt, for a time in the Congo and for a time in Cyprus. And if we would use the peacekeeping machinery more effectively, more quickly, being called upon it, the United Nations would demonstrate even more clearly that it has a very important role in the world. Now, I appreciate some of its weaknesses, but our objective should be to make it work and to help it succeed. Certainly, it would be a disaster, in my judgment, if the United Nations would fold up. Yes. Yeah, a little louder. Well, I think that I understand that the captain was released without any penalty, which I think was a great mistake. I think if he violated the law, the law should be enforced. We have a bill that was enacted in the last session of Congress that provided penalties for fishermen of foreign nations that invaded our fishing zone, which was enlarged to 12 miles. And if, because of the pressure of the State Department, this is not enforced, I think it's just going to encourage more violations, and I think it's grossly unfair to our fishermen. I think those penalties should be enforced. Not enforcing them creates disrespect for the law and merely encourages further violations. Yes. Well, I think that's like asking, how do you stand on sin? I'm against it. I'm against it. It's just deterioration. I think that this is, again, one of the tragic concomitants of our being engaged in war. Revitalizing our cities, fighting crime, are one of our pressing problems. But if all our energies and a large portion of our wealth is diverted in the business of killing abroad, we are going to neglect and are neglecting our pressing domestic problems. And this is one of the many reasons why I am opposed to our military ventures overseas and our tremendous expenditure in armament and in military defense when it's completely unnecessary to the neglect of our pressing problems at home. And we're going to see that more and more as this war deepens and there's more and more neglect of our important domestic issues. Yes? Could what? Could they lead to bankruptcy? Yes, they could. They certainly could. Yes. Yes, I do, but communist China would not have probably accepted me for now. Let me say that in answer to this question, we must first understand the background of China. China during the 19th century was a victim of all kinds of invasions, crimes, penalties by the Western powers. And their enemy, in the psychology of the Chinese, is Western imperialism. Now, I consider communism a grave error, a kind of a disease in which nations fall into, as a reaction to some other kind of abuse. And I think that instead of isolating the Chinese, if we invited them in and not considered them like pariahs, you might have a very different situation. Communism wears itself out, as it's wearing itself out in Russia. We're not going back to the oppression of Stalin again. Communism has failed pretty much wherever it's been tried. It failed in Guinea, it failed in Ghana, it failed in Indonesia. And I think that our policy of isolating the Chinese and treating them as if they were not fit for society the rest of the world really intensifies their bitterness and their feeling and perpetuates their communism. So I think that if we open the door to the Chinese, we would ultimately, not immediately, it would take time and patience, solve that problem. After all, they are a quarter of the population of the globe, and to continue to ignore them seems to be very short-sighted. Yes. You have to talk louder. Okay. Oh, you mean domestic firearms? Well, I do not feel that this legislation that has been introduced, that is current now in the Congress, which is designed to prevent criminals from getting guns, really will be effective at all. I think that anybody can still get a gun under this legislation, and for that reason, I do not favor it. I think it is just a deception. As at present, as the bill is now constituted, I intend to vote against it. I would like to see a limitation of arms going to people who misuse them, violence, but I do not think this legislation will do that effectively. Yes. Well, I've introduced a bill. It's a very modest bill. It merely provides a such modification of the Jones Act so that we will be able to use the Canadian ferry in connection with our own ferry to bring up some freight. I would like to see the entire Jones Act abolished as far as Alaska is concerned, and that we could use foreign ships to transport our goods because of the fact that we have a unique situation. We are, after all, virtually an island, although we are physically part of the continent. And maritime transportation is the key to the entry of all our needed supplies. And we have been subject ever since 1920, when the Merchant Marine Act of 1920, the so-called Jones Act, was passed, to a steamship monopoly and steadily rising freight rates. The situation is not as bad in the rail belt as it is in southeastern and in northwestern Alaska, because at long last you've had competition here. There's another line here, Sealand, which fights Alaska Steam. So the rates down here have been kept relatively moderate as compared to the rates in other parts of Alaska. But I think that we, considering the interests of Alaska, I'd like to see the entire Jones Act abolished. Now that would not be easy to do because of the pressure of maritime interests and the maritime labor union. Yes. Do I think what? Well, I think the Canadians are waiting for Uncle Sam to do it, and I think the Canadians should pay it. I think that if we have money to spend on highways, we need it right inside of Alaska. And besides which, we now have a very nice alternative route to come to Alaska, and that's by the ferry system. It now has two variants. You can drive your car to Vancouver, and then go up Vancouver Island, take the Canadian ferry to Prince Rupert, and then on up, and then to Haines, and then drive into Alaska. Or you can drive all the way to Prince Rupert and get on the state ferry there. And that is a very pleasant way of traveling. You go up the beautiful inside passage, and you can see it both coming and going. I think that the paving of Alaska Highway is desirable, but I don't think it is as necessary as it was before we had the ferry system. Yes. I think the future economy of Alaska is very promising. We are just in our infancy. We have great undeveloped resources which can be developed. We are doing a unique thing, a state developing a trade with a foreign nation. The trade with Japan has great promise. It's already started. The Japanese need a great many of the raw materials which we have, but for which there is no market elsewhere or in the 48 states. We are developing a great tourist industry which will help tremendously by being the air crossways of the Northern Hemisphere, by which planes from Europe deposit their passengers here on the way to Asia and back and forth. I think it's very hopeful. I don't think we have barely tapped our great resources, and I think we can, and I think the economy of Alaska is very hopeful. Yes. And can you talk about us? Well, I would say that I think we do far too much for foreign countries in proportion to what we do for our own. This becomes evident all the time, and I've talked about it frequently on the floor of the Senate. The dual standard by which we do things to foreign countries that we wouldn't dream of doing at home. We pour billions of dollars in these countries without any quid pro quo. Now, when Chile had an earthquake, we made an immediate grant of $20 million, and then we made a so-called loan of $100 million at 0.75% interest and no repayment of principal for 10 years. Well, no one thinks for a moment that that loan will ever be repaid. It's a gift. And yet, when we had an earthquake here, we had to pay 3% and not 0.75% on the loans that were made. Now, it is true that the government did do pretty well by us in the rehabilitation earthquake, but I can see no reason why we shouldn't have been treated at least as well as any foreign country under similar circumstances. And there are many examples of that sort of thing. We subsidize industries in foreign countries. We give them loans at negligible interest rates, which will not be repaid. I see no reason why we shouldn't do that to an undeveloped state as Alaska is coming into the Union after 92 years of neglect. Yes. Well, I think the element of concealment there and setting our young men off the spine is very deplorable. I think that the secrecy was the chief objection. I think if the United States feels that our young men should be subsidized so they can present the cause of the United States abroad when they meet with students in totalitarian countries, they should do it openly and appropriate sums of money, just as we appropriate sums of money for Fulbright scholarships, and let it be known. I think the secrecy is the objectionable part of it. I think it should be a policy that should be above board and open and clearly expressed and clearly outlined. And then we could state it on that basis. But the clandestine quality of this, the concealment of it, and the sudden exposure, I think is rather distressing. Any other questions before we adjourn? Yes. Well, I think it is very wrong for us to be spending $5 billion annually on the moon and neglecting many vital problems on Earth. The reason this costs so much is we're determined to get there first for the most of it. We want to beat the Russians to the moon. I think that's very unimportant. Now, I don't think it's important whether we get to the moon in 69 or 70 or 71. I think it would be just as well if we delayed it and did gradually. I think the space effort has some substantial scientific value in addition to the actual results. But I think the speed and the cost that's related to speed are entirely unnecessary. I think that space exploration is much less interesting anyhow, since we came to the conclusion there are no little green men on Mars and it's going to be an empty planet. Yes. In fact, we're getting out of the war. Well, there's a great deal of sentiment for it, for stopping the escalation, but the president is apparently determined to bomb the opposition into something, submission. I don't think it's going to work. I think that it has merely hardened their resistance, and it's not unnatural. I mean, if someone approaches you and wants to talk with you and starts by beating you over the head, they're not going to be very kindly disposed to sit down and talk. You have to say, well, stop hitting me, and then let's see what we can get together. I think that's the situation between nations, it will be between individuals. Yes. The internal chaos in China? Well, unfortunately, we know very little about it, which is due to our isolation of China. I think this is one of the errors. I think that if we recognize China and had diplomatic exchange, we'd be in a position to know what's going on. Certainly, there was a very deep-seated revolution there, which in a way disposes of the fear that China is a great enemy, a great menace, and there was a deep-seated revolution there. And obviously, the communist bloc, which was solid a few years ago, is widely split. It should be a great advantage to the free world, in that we do not face the combined forces of Russia and China and any other communist nation. The communist world is deeply and apparently irrevocably divided. And I think that it would be useful if we could find more about it and encourage coming closer to the Western world as a free way of life. I think Russia would move that way much more rapidly, and we would move much more rapidly in that direction if it weren't for the war in Vietnam, where the Russians feel obliged to come to the rescue of a sister communist state such as North Vietnam. And this postpones for some time any prospect of better relations with any of these totalitarian powers. Well, I think when the time comes, we should ask for a good quid pro quo. I think they would like to have our water, and if we could spare it when the time comes, we shouldn't be selfish about it. But I think we should properly ask them, what are you going to do for us? There are plenty of things they could do for us. Yes. Well, I think it's very difficult that when you have a surplus, you feel kindly disposed to a few starving people, but I think the time is coming, and it's so cheap that no amount of food that we can produce is going to suffice to feed the burgeoning masses of India and other countries, and I think it's about time we fed them, better stop contraception and help them do that. Well, I think there are no other questions. I think we've reached the end of our time. You're very welcome.